from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Brazil reached a grim milestone yesterday. For the first time, daily coronavirus deaths exceeded those in the United States. Peru, Chile, and Mexico are also struggling to contain growing outbreaks. Meanwhile, other countries are making significant strides against the virus, including Japan, which imposed no restrictions on residents' movements and kept businesses, from hairdressers to restaurants, open. As COVID-19 has spread across the globe, different countries with different political systems have all been dealing with very similar challenges. We'll talk with experts about what early lessons can be learned from countries across the globe on how best to tackle the coronavirus pandemic. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As coronavirus deaths in the United States approach 100,000, experts are warning that Latin America is the next global hotspot for COVID-19. Brazil now has one of the largest outbreaks right after the United States, and public health officials are searching for answers as to what policy responses work best, why some countries are able to stop the spread, and why some are struggling to contain the virus. Comparisons are difficult, however, because countries have varying healthcare systems and can even count coronavirus deaths differently. In this hour, we want to talk about what measures governments around the world have taken and how those measures may have influenced the fatalities and economic damage caused by COVID-19. Joining us is Dr. Ashish Jha. He's director of the Harvard Global Health Institute and professor of global health at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And welcome, Professor Jha. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
And we also want to welcome Thomas Hale, who joins us for this hour. He's associate professor at Oxford University, is involved in assembling an index of the COVID-19 responses from 170 countries. Welcome, Professor Hale. Good to have you.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Let me begin, if I may, Thomas Hale, with you. It seems in some ways, in fact, I was just looking at a BBC report on this, that such comparisons are difficult for some of the reasons I just cited, different way of counting deaths, different healthcare systems and so forth. How are you able to pretty much move or crystallize this data that you get and make it worthwhile for us?
That's absolutely right. We're seeing a very difficult problem of trying to track in real time a whole range of different government responses. The primary way governments are handling this virus is not through medical treatment, obviously, because we're still waiting for vaccines and treatments, but instead through these restrictive measures to reduce the transmission of the disease. So what we try to do is record different indicators for what governments are doing or not doing on those measures, for example, school closings, travel restrictions, stay-at-home orders, that kind of thing, and we code the severity of them. Are they very restrictive or not very restrictive? And through that method, we're able to create a very comparable measure at a high level of abstraction for about 170 countries around the world, and that gives us a first cut at assessing what impacts these policies are having on the spread of the disease.
You even get into elements such as trust and how that works and as a criterion.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the big questions is trying to understand why governments respond differently. And factors like trust can be one really important component. So, for example, we see on average countries where governments trust are less well trusted by their publics taking more restrictive measures more quickly, which might suggest that these kinds of measures could be ameliorated in a more high trust context.
So what are you discovering as a result of this? Maybe you could just lay out for us what you're tracking and what early data at least hints at and conclusions. I realize that we're still in an early stage, but if you could lay that out for us, it'd be very useful, I think.
So one big conclusion that emerges is governments really tended to copy each other around the middle of March. Before March, there was a lot of sort of pockets of action in East Asia, but in about a two-week period around when the WHO, the World Health Organization, declared a global pandemic, we saw most countries beginning to adopt similar kinds of measures. And actually, they tended to do so in more or less the same order, first starting with public health campaigns, then moving to international travel restrictions, then moving to other kinds of measures like closing schools and workplaces. But what's interesting about that is most governments seem to have been following a sort of follow the leader model instead of following what the World Health Organization was recommending, which was to tailor those kinds of measures to the spread of the disease in a country. And so we're seeing a bit more followership than kind of an evidence-based approach to adopting these measures.
And again, Thomas Hale is with us, associate professor at Oxford, and he's assembling an index of the COVID-19 responses from countries around the world. Dr. Ashish Jha is director of Harvard's Global Health Institute and professor of global health at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And Dr. Jha, I was struck by something you said about we're still, if you compare this to a baseball game, just in the third inning, which means we've got a lot of way to go here. And I'm wondering, when we make these kind of comparisons, since some of them are so stark, for example, I was struck by the fact that Germany was milder in its restrictions, obviously, than Italy, but it has been much more successful in containing the virus. A lot of that kind of data confuses.
Yeah, so thanks again for having me on. You know, this is, it's worth remembering that we are early. And I do like to use the analogy of baseball, with apologies to my colleague from the UK. But, you know, we, I think, are still early in the pandemic. We're not anywhere near halfway. And that's assuming a very optimistic that the pandemic comes to an end sometime in 2021 with a vaccine. And the reason that's important is that to assume that where we are now is essentially what things will look like 6 or 9 months from now is pretty risky. And so we always have to have a little bit of humility about what we're seeing and how to interpret it. That said, there's no doubt that countries have responded very, very differently from each other. Simplistic ideas about, you know, Asian countries have responded well and European countries have responded badly, that kind of thing, I think turns out to be largely not right. It really has varied from country to country. And we've seen the results of it in that some places have done very well, few cases, very few deaths, and other countries that have just had a kind of a catastrophically bad response with lots of people getting sick, lots of people dying, and economies wrecked as a result of that poor response.
And I want to get into that with both of you in terms of the economies being wrecked. But you mentioned Asian countries versus European countries, and it's impossible to generalize about continents this way. But I was struck in doing some research about this. Taiwan, for example, wanted to be asked by the WHO to participate, but this gets into politics. They've only had 7 deaths, and there was a special report that came out from their director general that said, we think we're doing things very well, and we think the world ought to know about that. And also, I was thinking about Singapore, where they've had a pretty robust infrastructure that began after SARS 17 years ago, but they seem to be doing everything right. They banned travel from the mainland, China, in January. They also got into, people being ordered out of schools and restaurants, but getting their temperatures taken before they did that. In other words, we have all kinds of things where we have data that shows modestly success compared to what's going on in so many European countries, especially like Europe and Spain.
Yeah, and so it is remarkable when I look at the countries that have had really the very best responses. And I mean, and my judge of that, by the way, is number of cases, number of deaths, and what you've had to do in terms of affecting your economy. There is obviously, it's not random, right? There is that pattern of, you pointed out, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, Hong Kong. But I'd also throw on that list Germany. So it isn't just the East Asian countries. Now, those East Asian countries, as you suggested, a lot of it is they had a whole kind of preparation mentality coming out of SARS in 2003. I think that helped a lot. I think the single biggest feature in my mind between countries that have done well and countries that have not is not what continent they're located on, but how seriously they took this outbreak and how quickly they moved. And what they all did was a little different from each other, but taking it seriously and moving early was the single biggest determining factor in my mind of why it is that some places have done so much better than others.
Well, you mentioned South Korea. I mean, they started testing pretty early, very early, in fact. They have probably the most comprehensive protective measures in place right now, including public phone booths for testing. I mean, they're doing testing on a basis that really probably in some ways is incomparable anywhere in the world, aren't they?
Yeah, they've been fabulous. And, you know, our president has several times tried to bring out that, you know, our testing matches that of South Korea. And what I always sort of remind people is our outbreak has been about 20 times larger per capita than South Korea. And so our testing has just not anywhere, you know, kind of kept up to what they've done. And again, you know, they did it early and they moved quickly. And even recently, you know, they had somebody who went to a nightclub who was infected and spread it to a large number of people. And within 3 days, they had tested, can't remember the exact number, something like 25,000 folks, and totally brought that outbreak to a close. I mean, they're aggressive, they're impressive in how they do this, and they stay on top of it. And this is a virus that really punishes you if you fall behind. And that's been the story of South Korea. They have not fallen behind on this, and that's why they can keep on top of any outbreaks that do come up.
We stay with Asia for a moment. I want to, of course, get back to Professor Hale. But before I do that, can you talk about Japan? Because Japan seems to be sort of a mystery or an enigma in some ways. They have a lot of older people. They have fewer deaths. Some are even speculating there may be a different strain of the coronavirus there. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Japan is, honestly, it is a bit of a mystery. And I'm not particularly convinced of the different strain theory. There's a lot of talk that pops up every once in a while about different strains of the virus. As far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, there's one strain of the virus, lots of little mutations and differences that are common. So I don't think, at least based on the evidence, I don't subscribe to that theory. Japan's a bit of a mystery in that they have not had the kind of same level of aggressive testing that South Korea has. But Japan also took the disease, I think, pretty seriously. Not very much kind of initially, but then they had the whole Diamond Princess event with the cruise ship. And since then, I think, you know, universal masking has been a really important part of Japan's strategy. Really good communication about avoiding crowds. So there's a lot that they've done that is pretty evidence-based. But I'm going to be honest, I still am a little perplexed about why they've done as well as they have. And of course, we worry that maybe in the next wave they won't. But we really do need to learn better, and I'm not sure I totally have unraveled that mystery.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of speculations, no less than about 48 reasons, including the language, which supposedly involves less droplets when you speak Japanese than in other languages, or low obesity rates, or a culture of mask wearing. There are a lot of explanations, but as you say, it remains somewhat of a mystery. Let me go back to Thomas Hale. And Thomas Hale, can we go back to talking about findings and trust in government? I want to dig into that a little more with you.
Yeah, well, I think the Japan example also suggests that this trust factor might be important. And one of the commonalities in some of the East Asian countries that we've looked at, Japan, one of them, but also Taiwan, Singapore, as you mentioned, is that people do seem to follow government advice on these public health measures, in part because of the experience with SARS, as was mentioned, but also I think there's a higher level of social trust that can be used productively there. So that seems to be important for not just determining how governments act, but also what effects these kinds of actions have on public behavior, which is ultimately the thing we need to affect to control the disease.
So what do we learn about Sweden and all of this? Because there's probably been more attempt at accepting public trust there than anywhere else, hoping to build up herd immunity, and yet the numbers, for example, are much greater than they are in other, and the mortality rate, I mean, of course, than any other Scandinavian country. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think as Professor Joss says, it's still often early to say in this trajectory how it's going to play out. But I'd say there are two things I would take away from looking at Sweden. First, the rate of growth of the disease, the rate of spread in the disease, does seem to be slower than some of the other countries, for example, here in the UK. And the total response that the government has put in place is a bit less stringent. So that might suggest that some of the trust, some of the behavioral shifts that happen just based on recommendations as opposed to requirements might be helping there. But I think it's also clear that the Swedish government has taken a slightly different approach in thinking about what the outcome they're trying to maximize is. And they've been less concerned with stopping infection wholesale and more about thinking over the longer term. And that's quite different from many governments, I would say.
It is indeed. And these extended lockdowns or questions about extended lockdowns which Sweden did not have versus an open economy are sharply etched now in many of our minds. Is it fair to say that if you have harsher responses, it means more economic suffering?
Well, one of the unfortunate outcomes of the Swedish example is that because all of their neighbors, on which they're extremely dependent economically, have shut down their economies, Sweden's economy hasn't done as well as you might have hoped, given the lesser level of lockdown there. So one of the difficulties is that no country is an island from coronavirus, but also no country is an island from economic response measures. We're all in this together. So the Swedish economy hasn't performed as well as they might have wished, given the lower level of lockdown.
And if I could go back to you, Ashish Jha, and just get from you a sense of where we see, when we make these comparisons on the global nature of different sovereign states, where we see what we would call success and can find it attributable to specific factors, as opposed to where we've seen, you know, and I think Brazil probably is a conspicuous example of perhaps the United States as well, of failure and high mortality rates. Of course, you got different populations and density of population, all of that I realize, but is there, in other words, what I'm getting at here, is there a spectrum? Is there a kind of polarized spectrum here?
Yeah, so there very much is. And just to quickly go back to Sweden, I mean, you know, the problem, there are a couple of things about Sweden that are, and this will feed into your answering your question. You know, half the households in Sweden are single people living alone. Automatic social distancing. It's a very different society than many, many other places around the world. And by all metrics, Sweden is doing, I think, is the Swedish experiment will end up being a failure, because their economy, as Professor Hale said, is doing as badly, if not worse, than the other Nordic countries. So the lockdown hasn't helped. And their death rates are just dramatically higher than the other Nordic countries. So it's not really clear what they have bought themselves. A lot more death at the same economic cost strikes me as not a success story. But when you look more broadly across the globe, what you see is absolutely the importance of trust, which we've been hearing a lot about, which I think is really important, and just governance and countries and leaders communicating effectively, being proactive. And you know, the striking difference between places like New Zealand or Germany versus Brazil. And, you know, one of the things about this virus that's so insidious is that you can really mess things up and it won't sort of show up for many, many weeks. And so we saw this in the US, where we basically were blind and ignored the virus from late January all the way through early March. And things looked fine until they didn't. And Brazil is going through that. And Russia has gone through that. And, you know, ultimately what happens is at some point you realize that you've got exponential growth, large numbers of cases. And then the only choices are let a lot of people die or shut down the economy. And countries that have been proactive have been able to avoid those two horrible choices. And but we definitely see a large spectrum of success and failure that I think is a lot about political leadership and communication and having a strategy for countering the virus.
Dr. Ashish Jha is director of the Harvard Global Health Institute and professor of global health at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Thomas Hale is associate professor at Oxford and has been involved in assembling an index of the COVID-19 responses from countries around the world. Latin America is now pretty much staked out as the next hotbed. What do we know there, Thomas Hale?
Well, as Dr. Jha said, the rate of infection in Brazil is really accelerating quickly, and that no doubt follows from the patchwork of responses we've seen. A lack of response at the federal level has meant that every state in Brazil, every city, has adopted different kinds of measures. And so, sadly, we're learning just how much that kind of variation matters. One of the cautions—
You should mention that the Prime Minister Bolsonaro has been blaming the mayors and the governors, of course, and not taking any responsibility. Does this sound familiar?
Indeed. So we're seeing a lot of politics around this thing, with people who are anti-lockdown trumpeting the economic benefits of resisting it, people who are worried about public health outcomes countervailing that measure quite strongly. And so this all, of course, does not add up to a very well-balanced, calibrated, evidence-based response. And unfortunately, outcome is going to be measured in death.
What about, let me go to Mexico for a moment with you, Ashish Jha, because López Obrador on the 18th of May actually opened up a lockdown economy in three phases. The first phase, I think, had to do with protection against COVID-19 for cases that were confirmed, places where there were no confirmed cases, excuse me. And then the second case, economically vital sections, and then moving in, which includes, I guess, auto manufacturing, construction, mining. In other words, there's a plan here. There's a plan here by the president, who also was, I don't know if he was joking or not, he said he had a $2 bill that he carried in his wallet along with a lucky clover that would go against coronavirus. But these kind of plans that we see in so many different states separately, is there anything that suggests a plan that's working here, that's really effective? I mean, we were talking about how much of an enigma Japan is, but is there a plan that we can see that's you can actually prognosticate positive things with.
Yeah. So when I, you know, when I look at the data from Mexico, I understand the plan. I can see it, and yet in the numbers, things look very concerning, right? So things, the number of cases is rising. There's nothing near a flattening of the curve, as Americans have gotten to know that term. We're still seeing really every day new cases outpacing the number of new cases from the day before. So whatever the plan is in Mexico, it's not working. It's not getting the virus under control. And at some point, what happens, the experience of every country, is that at some point it becomes untenable to keep that exponential growth going because so many people get sick, so many people get infected, that it really undermines the confidence people have in engaging in the economy. And you end up having to sort of shut things back down again, or shut things down for the first time if you hadn't before. So, you know, without getting into the details of the policy response of Mexico, as I look at the numbers, I'm pretty concerned that it's not heading in the right direction.
What about a country like, I don't want to dwell too much on this, but Nicaragua, which we don't have any real numbers from, but there's a huge turnout just over the weekend, I believe, to celebrate Ortega, their chief of, head of the government, but also solidarity in terms of corona victims all over the world. But here they had masses of people who were congregating to do this celebration.
Yeah, photos and videos like that make me really anxious because, you know, if you ask me what is going on in Nicaragua, the answer is I don't know. We've looked at the data and there's just the data so scant that I can't tell you whether they have a small, medium, or large burden of disease. But I think the key part to understand is, first of all, this is a global pandemic, so no country is going to escape it. There's no country or group of people who have natural immunity. And so nothing about Nicaragua tells me that it's going to, you know, be spared from the disease that's affecting all of us. And when you see those large crowds, you worry a lot that they will be the focal point for a large outbreak. And if you're not testing and aggressively managing, then you're going to only discover it when people show up to the hospital in dire straits and a lot of people die. So that's the concern of things like that.
Talking about the pandemic worldwide, and we do want to hear from you, what are your questions or observations about the different ways that countries are responding to the pandemic? You can give us a call now, and I invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you. The number to call is 866-733-6786. I'll repeat that, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Again, we're talking with Dr. Ashish Jha, who is director of Harvard Global Health Institute and professor of global health at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and Thomas Hale, associate professor at Oxford University. They're assembling an index of the COVID-19 responses from countries around the world. And again, if you have questions about countries around the world, or if you have some observations about what's working or not working, we want to hear from you. Join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking comparatively about different nations and not only how they deal with coronavirus, but what kind of effects the plans have had or their dealings with the coronavirus have had. And looking at a comment from a listener who says, a man in South Korea who purposefully violated quarantine will go to prison for 4 months. I can't see people complying with stay-at-home orders here after a contact tracer tells them they are exposed. And another listener writes, Japanese doctors told people to gargle with salt water every day. We said there wasn't anything to this, but maybe this is preventative. Well, you can certainly add your voice to this, and we want any questions or comments you might have. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. I'll go back, Dr. Ashish Jha, to you for a moment. We were talking about Sweden, and Sweden chose not to impose shelter in place because said it was looking at the longer term. And now experts there think that the government may have rushed to put lockdowns in place without plans for what would replace them. Your response?
Yeah, so I do think that we have to sort of see how the next few months go. But part of the reason to lock down early and delay the spread of the virus is I believe over time we are going to get better at treating this virus. We already have one therapy that we didn't have a month ago. That's remdesivir. My suspicion is that by end of the summer into the fall, we'll have more therapies. And obviously, if we're really lucky, by the end of the calendar year, or probably more in 2021, we'll have a vaccine. And so anything you can do to delay things, anything you can do to buy time is good for your population. And so that's why I've been puzzled by Sweden's efforts. Now, Sweden does have some natural advantages, as I alluded to, including a high degree of trust, including a society where a lot of people live alone. But as I said before, I don't know that I see this experiment being able to be replicated elsewhere. And I'm not sure that it ought to be, given the numbers that we're seeing right now.
What do we know, Thomas Hale, at this point about Africa? I was reading about Senegal because they have the Pasteur Institute there, and they have certainly done a lot in terms of just teaming up and releasing do-it-yourself test kits and that sort of thing. But Senegal is probably an outlier here, aren't they?
Yes, I think it is in some ways. Although, as Professor Joss said, what we've learned so far is that early action can be very effective. And in Africa, the disease has arrived a little bit later than in other parts of the world. Has begun to spread only after measures have been taken in other countries. And so actually many African countries have entered this in a slightly more prepared phase, also building on, in many cases, their experience with Ebola a few years ago. So governments in Africa have actually confronted this in a bit more proactively than places that were hit earlier in the wave. And one place you can see that really having some effect, I think, is in South Africa, which despite not having as many resources as other countries, has pursued a very aggressive testing program, building on its experience in treating HIV/AIDS, and is using that to really target its measures and to deliver healthcare more effectively. So it's certainly not through the weeds, but I think we're seeing a much better response there than we would have seen had South Africa not been proactive.
And let me bring some callers on here. Mark, we'll go to you first. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I was curious, how has the virus affected the overall death rate of countries? I don't know if anyone's actually studied that, but does that make sense?
How has it affected the overall death rate? That's what we call mortality rate.
Like, are people, yeah, the mortality rate, I guess, is what, I'm not exactly sure of the scientific term, but like, you know, we know how many people are dying from the coronavirus, but are other types of deaths, you know, less or more, or how much does it add to the overall mortality rate of the country?
I think I know where you're going with this, Mark, and I want to go to Dr. Jha again, because some of these numbers, again, can be very confusing. There are people in different nations who are complaining that their loved ones died of corona, but it wasn't necessarily tallied up that way, and vice versa.
Yeah, so as you might imagine, on one hand, it's a little bit complicated to tease apart, but there is a bottom line answer. And the bottom line answer is, in countries that have been hit hard, and I'll pick the US and UK as two examples, total mortality, excess mortality, as we say, by looking at how many people typically die in let's say, April or May, and compared to how many people died in April or May this year, much, much higher, much higher. So there's no question that more people are dying right now than they have in the years past when you it's all said and done. And that's despite the fact that certain types of death are way down. So motor vehicle accident deaths are way down. And they're way down because people aren't driving, right? Because they're shut down. And so there have been all of these ways that we've lowered mortality. Again, that was not the original intention of the lockdown, was not to lower more motor vehicle accidents. But despite those, the overall mortality in these societies have been really high in April and May, just because the catastrophic death that we've seen from COVID. I mean, 100,000 Americans have died, 90,000 of them largely, you know, in April and May. I mean, most of those deaths occurred in these last 2 months. So it's such a large number that it has swamped any kind of negative effects of any of the other diseases.
Thomas Hale, if I can go back to you, Bill poses a question here. He wants to know, couldn't the differences in statistics from different countries be at least partially due to cultural differences in social norms? In general, some countries have more compliant populations who follow health and safety regulations consistently and without question. Many Americans, on the other hand, are individualistic and suspicious of authority. It gets us back to what we were talking about before with trust, and I was struck by the wide range of numbers in terms of the percentages of people who trust their government. Very low, high in Sweden, very low in Romania, just to use two examples. But if I could go to you on this again, Professor Hale?
Yes, that's right. So obviously government measures have different effects in different countries based on a whole bunch of different country characteristics. Trust is one important one, but also things like level of income of a country matter quite a lot. The work we've done so far, we've seen a big difference, for example, in the change in people's mobility in the least developed countries, low-income countries where people have to go out of their homes every day to work in order to put food on the table the next day. So obviously these kinds of measures will have different effects. The big challenge analytically is teasing apart what those are and thinking really what are the, where can we get these policies to have the most effect in a given context for the least economic cost? Because as we go forward and governments need to ramp them back up and down as the virus spreads, waxes and wanes around the world, we're going to need to be able to do more targeting measures in order to keep a sustained public buy-in for this kind of response.
There were, in an article in the New York Times, different factors that were outlined in terms of making for major differences between individual countries. And what they focused on were demographics on the one hand, but also the cultures. And they included environment and speed of government response. Now, those four are not necessarily by any means inclusive, but they do cover the territory, don't they?
Yeah, so those are four important ones. The difficulty is that we really need to get quite specific about exactly how these different factors work together, because the effects are not likely to be linear or simple or even the same over time. So, for example, if a country had a very stringent response, people were very compliant with that response in the first wave, there's not necessarily a guarantee they're going to do the same in the second wave. So even though we can begin now to use the data we're collecting to evaluate these first round of effects, we need to be quite cautious in how we think about the problem going forward. An evidence-based approach is necessary, but we're building that evidence base in real time as we go through this. So it needs to be a really rapid kind of learning that governments should be following.
And Dr. Jha, here's a tweet from a listener named Kimber. It says, I'm wondering if you could talk about the severity of second waves in comparison of first waves once cities around the world have reopen. And I think that's particularly an appropriate question now with the World Health Organization essentially talking about a second, I don't think they use the word wave, but it's basically what they were saying recently, and how much we need to be prepared. Now, we're learning a good deal thanks to Thomas Hale and others who have compiled a lot of data about what we need to do for the second wave. But let me get you to comment on that if you could. Dr. Jha?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, when you look at the modeling of what's going to happen over the next 12 to 18 months, and that's the timeline before we hope we have a vaccine, there's some people who believe that we're going to have a series of medium-sized waves. That we're unlocking now, and then there's going to be another wave in a month or two as number of cases rise, and we're going to have to shut down and then kind of be in this cycle of opening and closings. I'm a bit more optimistic than that. I don't think that's going to be necessary. But what I do suspect is a much more likely scenario is that we'll get through the summer months reasonably well. And this will be a global phenomenon too, but just staying with the US for a second, we'll get through the summer months with outbreaks, with some number of cases, but not having to shut down. And then we'll really get walloped in the fall with what will be a large number of cases, a large wave, and driven in large part by the weather getting cooler, people moving more indoors, all the things that are helpful for the summer months are going to be hurtful in the fall and winter months. And I suspect much of the Northern Hemisphere is going to go through that. The last point is, the Southern Hemisphere is going to be going through its winter soon. So we're going to learn a lot about how the virus behaves during the winter months. And that, I think, is going to be an important part of our modeling as we look into the fall and winter.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go to Judith next. Judith, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I wonder if your guest could speak a little bit about Argentina and the contrast with Brazil. Argentina, despite an absolutely devastating economy, but thanks to a new government that took office in December, shut down incredibly early with very few cases. And so far as I can read the data, have the contrast with Brazil is extraordinary, but of course the cost is going to be immense in terms of the economy, which was already in free fall. So I wonder if they could comment a little bit about the validity of the data that are coming out, which, as I read it, it's something like only a I think only a few hundred deaths or something in Argentina. And anyway, if they would discuss that contrast and their analysis of what is working and what the costs are going to be.
Judith, many thanks for that question. And Thomas Allen, I'm going to go to you on this. Of course, Bolsonaro is leading Brazil, and that's part of the big problem here. But contrast with Argentina, maybe we could bring Venezuela into it, too.
Alberto Fernandez, who took office there in December.
It's a new government there, as Judith said. Thomas Allen? Yeah.
Yeah, so two big differences I see in our data between Argentina and Brazil. One is in the timing. So Argentina did act, it looks like, about a week before Brazil did in terms of beginning to ramp up measures. But also those measures were more consistent across the country, even though there's variation within Argentina between different states, different provinces. The variation is much greater in Brazil. So we have a few more pockets in Brazil where the response was much weaker for much longer, allowing the virus to get really embedded in the population. And that's why we're seeing a sort of two order of magnitude difference in deaths between those two countries at the moment.
What do we know about Venezuela, though, under Maduro at this point?
So Venezuela has been a bit more proactive in the responses they've taken. We don't have very good information from Venezuela at the moment, though, on the compliance with those measures. So we're seeing the virus spread fairly rapidly there now. And I think there's also questions that I would ask around the data in terms of deaths that we're getting. The reported numbers are quite small, probably way too small for where the reality probably lies.
I want to go back, if I could, with you, Thomas Hale, though, just for a moment to Africa, because there was an article that said things started in Asia, then went to Europe, and the expectation is that maybe this timeline or trajectory will follow into Africa. And especially when you're dealing with places like sub-Saharan Africa, where do you get numbers from, or do you?
So many African countries have fairly good reporting systems, especially those that experienced Ebola or HIV/AIDS have built up public health facilities to track this kind of information, at least for the more urban areas. In more rural areas, of course, it's much more difficult, but hopefully we're not yet seeing massive spreads in those places. So I think that numbers across Africa are fairly robust compared to some other countries. I mean, for me, the key variable is not so much the capacity of countries to track these things, so of course that matters. It's more that testing, of course, tells us a lot about cases, and testing is a choice that governments make or don't make. And so we're getting better information where governments are more committed to getting that information.
And once more, Thomas Hale is Associate Professor in Global Public Policy at Oxford University. And let me get another caller on here. Terry joins us next. Terry, you're on. Morning.
You asked about stories about other countries. I had flown into Suriname on the 11th, and at the time there weren't any cases, but the taxi driver was telling me how they were really concerned, but they have the help of China. On the 13th, they diagnosed somebody with the virus who'd come from the Netherlands. They shut down the airport, shut down everything, and there was a plane that had arrived at 9 o'clock at night from the Netherlands that two people that I was meeting were on. At 9 o'clock, they couldn't get off the plane. They didn't get off till 5 o'clock in the morning because somebody on the plane they suspected had the virus. So, they were let off at 5 o'clock. And when I told somebody at the time, they said that was impossible. They couldn't have tested that quickly. But I assume they had testing from China. Now, I've looked it up. Since then, they've had a total of 10 cases, one death, and now they have no coronavirus.
Thank you for that call. I'm just wondering if you could respond to it, Dr. Zhao?
Sure. So I don't know much about the data from Suriname, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, what we do see in a lot of sort of smaller countries is obviously a low caseload right now. And again, I want to go back to the timeline issue for one more important point, which is, you know, if you begin with the outbreak of this virus starting in Wuhan in China, the places that got sort of seeded first, got the cases first, were places of real global travel. I mean, China has become this incredibly mobile country. And people were traveling out of Wuhan across the world in December, in January. And so when you look at where the cases have come initially, it was, you know, Seattle, I think the Bay Area probably got some early cases. Obviously, New York got a lot of cases from Europe, a lot of travel. So it's not surprising that places like Suriname or elsewhere won't get those cases initially. And it might take a while for the disease to really take a hold. But I would be very surprised if 6 months from now, the virus wasn't everywhere in the world, and that every country didn't have at least a good number of cases. And so it's just an issue of timing and where things start and where they travel to that makes it, 3 months into an 18-month pandemic or 6 months into an 18-month pandemic, it might look like, wow, these countries are doing really well and these ones aren't. But we have to be a little humble about how all of this is going to play out.
Well, I am particularly humble when I think about the figure, and I don't know how global the reach is in this, that about a third of us are walking around asymptomatic.
Yeah, so the asymptomatic disease thing is super interesting. This is very different from SARS classic, as we like to describe the SARS virus of 2003, where the people who were infectious tended to have symptoms. It makes it much, much easier to control. Our best guess right now is that 20% of people who get infected never develop symptoms. They go through the whole disease and they are infectious and they spread it to others, but largely just feel fine. And then there's another 20 to 30% of spread that happens among pre-symptomatic people. So these people are spreading when they feel fine, but then 2-3 days later will go on to develop symptoms. So they don't end up being wholly asymptomatic, but when they're spreading, they're asymptomatic. And that means as much as half of all disease is happening from people who don't have symptoms, as you said. And that makes controlling this so much harder than almost any other disease we've dealt with.
Another caller joining us from Milpitas. Kieran, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, good morning. I would like to know your guest take on India. I would like to know how the situation handled in the initial phase, and now more importantly now, as the country is very eager to open up, but we see also hear that cases are increasing. So how India should be going about handling it going forward, and also the data, if you can comment on where do you get the data and how credible the data you see from India. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. And Thomas Hale, I saw figures on India over the weekend, and they are high, very high.
Yes, but India actually reacted very quickly, followed the advice that I understand Professor John are giving, which is to get proactive quickly to try to get ahead of things. It went to a very high level of lockdown quite early in the spread of the disease in India. But now it's beginning to move back from that. And it's beginning to move back because this really high level of lockdown is not necessarily sustainable for large portions of the population. I mentioned before the difficulty of maintaining this effect on behavior in context where people need to work on a regular basis to get the basic necessities. And I think we're seeing that play out in many parts of India at the moment. And so the government really has no choice in some ways, but to begin to find ways to get the economy going, or it's going to face more problems as well. Unfortunately, we're seeing that very difficult choice reflected in the rising caseload in India, where the numbers I'm seeing, which are coming from the European Center for Disease Control, show a number of deaths that's approaching 10,000 at the minute. And probably it's going to keep going up.
And again, I get back to the trust issue. There was an article over the weekend that seemed to assert that where you have strong leaders like you do in India with Modi, or like we were talking before about Brazil with Bolsonaro, people put their trust these days in this pandemic more in these kind of strong men, as they're often referred to, than, shall we say, democratic governments, or more governments that have to do with citizens forming the government more than the top-down, shall we say, from dictator. I'm going to go back to you, Thomas Hale, and another question from a listener named Paul, who says, as a Vietnam War veteran, Paul writes, I've been tracking the pandemic in Vietnam, which has at least as good a record in dealing with it as New Zealand has, and it does not have the advantage of being an island. Interestingly, it has gotten almost no press here. It seems to be to me that there are significant lessons to be had. Can you comment?
Paul, thanks very much for that question. I think you're absolutely right. Vietnam is one of the cases I like to bring up all the time because it's not getting sufficient attention. One thing that I think is particularly interesting about Vietnam's approach is it's found a way, even as a not particularly wealthy country, to do really large-scale testing and contact tracing in a very kind of efficient way, using pooled samples, for example, and mobilizing community groups to assist with contact tracing. And that's really, I think, been an important part of their response. Vietnam, of course, very linked to China, probably had many kinds of travel interactions early on in the spread, but managed to be A, proactive, B, evidence-based, and C, really got the testing and contact tracing going in its own way at an early date. So I think those are important factors in its success.
Another listener, Barbara, says, why haven't you included the results from Greece, which are extremely good despite its economic problems? The population has been inoculated for TB with the BCG vaccine for over 50 years. Can we talk about that? Well, Greece has had a pretty good record. They acted very quickly. As far as the TB vaccine, what are your thoughts, Professor Hale?
So not so familiar with the TB vaccine experience. Maybe Professor Jia, you could speak to that part. But they certainly had an early and proactive response. And actually, that we saw that across not just Greece, but also other parts of Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, the Balkans. Governments that often get critiqued for not being effective at managing the economy actually did quite a good job on average here in getting ahead of the disease. Of course, as Professor Jia says, though, we need to take the long-term view here and see how that plays out as economies begin to need to reopen in the coming months.
Yeah, Professor Jia, there has been a lot of talk about tuberculosis prophylactics being given, especially in Germany. And I'd like your thoughts about that, but I'd also like your thoughts in response to a listener named Ron who says, given the statement that Germany is doing well, what are their exact practices in terms of masks, et cetera, testing, tracing, compared practices here in the Bay Area, which seems to be okay? Dr. Jia?
Yes, yeah, so a few thoughts. First of all, I want to give a shout out to Vietnam too. It's just it's a phenomenal success story and has gotten way too little attention. So agreeing with Professor Hale on this, that it's really, and part of it is just how proactive they were, how quickly they got going. So I think it is another example of a great country in terms of its response. The BCG vaccine thing is interesting. It's popped up a lot and people keep bringing it up as, you know, could that be the reason we see lower rates of disease in Africa, in South Asia? And the short answer is the jury's out on this. The reason to believe it could be a real thing is that BCG vaccine, while not all that great at protecting you from TB, which was the original idea, does seem to have some immune modulatory effects. And there's some theory that maybe for respiratory viruses, it makes you have a much less severe form. The evidence here is very, very, very weak. There's some really nice large randomized controlled trials happening right now. And I suspect over the next 2-3 months, we'll have much better data on the BCG vaccine.
Dr. Jha, if I could get your response also to a listener named Gregory, who puts things very bluntly. He says, how can you possibly gauge the effectiveness of COVID policies when the data are so uniformly varied, incomplete, and untrustworthy everywhere?
Well, it's
not entirely true everywhere, but yeah, you see his point, I think.
The data is always incomplete. That's we never have perfect data. So to me, the saying, we've had a few even scientists say, well, the data is not very good. Yeah, welcome to life. I mean, life is always full of incomplete data. That's not interesting. The interesting question is, how incomplete is it? Where are the errors likely to be? How much are you likely to be missing the truth? And can you make some reasonable estimates? And based on all of that, I think we have plenty of data. Would I like better data? Of course. But we have a pretty good feel for how deadly this disease is. We have a pretty good feel for how widespread the disease is. Not everywhere. There are plenty of places where I feel like I'm flying much more blindly than others. But I think we have enough data, and we certainly have enough data when we look at 100,000 Americans having died in the last 2 months to not be confused about, do we have some information about this virus? We have better data on this outbreak than almost any outbreak in history. So, yes, it's imperfect, but it's really, we know a lot more than we might think otherwise.
I'm going to read one more comment here and then go to another caller. The comment is from Chris, who writes, one of the incorrect notions by policymakers is that the number of cases is important, but that's not right. It's whether the problem is increasing or decreasing. I think if people think of it more as a house fire, that would help motivate the right behavior. If you saw a small fire in your house, you wouldn't say, well, it's just a small fire. It's growing. You have to move to put a fire out with fast and aggressive action as soon as you see it. And our flawed policy responses did not do that. Here's Briggs, another caller joining us. Briggs, you're on. Good morning. Thank you for waiting.
Hi, good morning. I was curious about the effect. I know specifically with New York, they're saying around 40% of people might have contracted the virus. And I'm wondering how natural herd immunity is going to affect the second or third waves to come.
It's a good question. I thank you for it. Briggs, go to you on this, Dr. Shah.
Yeah, so the best data on New York coming out of the big study that the New York State sponsored, 13% of people across New York State and 22% or so, I'm off, maybe off by 1 or 2% there in New York City, maybe it's 24%. So New York City obviously was hit incredibly hard with that wave, and about maybe as much as 1/4 of New Yorkers were infected and develop antibodies. It says even New York is far from herd immunity. Herd immunity, there's some controversy about at what level of infection, somewhere between 60 and 80%, 60, 65% is the number that people throw out. But there is a likelihood that the virus will continue spreading, won't completely shut off at 65, and as much as 80% of people may end up getting infected. Even if you take the low end of estimates of mortality, so the mortality estimate, my best number is 0.8% based on the evidence, that about 8 out of 1,000 people die. But even if the low end is 0.5%, that's still millions of Americans dying. We don't want that.
We'll leave it there. And Dr. Shah, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you with us this opening hour of Forum. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you, Thomas Hale. Good to have you with us as well. Appreciate your being with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. And we have another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to talk about what to do during the summertime and what's safe to do and, well, what you can count on doing for that matter, not only here, but maybe some of you who are thinking traveling beyond California. Stay tuned. That's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.